Part 1. 2057 Plus. 1. Parry Boyce looked up from the rippled red surface of the comet. He cuffed down his helmet binocs, keyed in mid-zoom, and waited for the image to stabilize. Only a breath of thrust held 50,000 tons of ship over his head. The precious mass driver was fully extended now, but still braced alongside Rockhopper. A spray of flickering blue lights near the head of the driver showed activity still taking place around the jammed deployment gear. Chrome-yellow robots worked the repair duty, with one tiny, suited figure hovering to the side. He knew it was Svetlana, even before his helmet dropped an icon onto her figure. They hadn't parted well. He'd been on her case about the repairs, but only because Bella was on his case. It was getting to them all, sitting out here, doing nothing. Parry stood on the floodlit edge of the abyss that he had cut into the skin of the comet. The cylindrical shaft was geometrically perfect, an intrusion of order into the otherwise chaotic landscape of the crust. It was 100 meters deep and 50 meters wide, the curving side already lined with a neat, laser-smooth plaque of hardened blue-gray spray rock. He voiced on some music from the Orlan 19's files, and lost himself in the soaring Qawwali of Nusrat Fateh Ali Khan. After what could have been minutes or hours, the floods picked out the moving shadow of another suit lumbering towards him. Whoever it was had just emerged from one of the dome-shaped surface tents set back 20 meters from the rim of the shaft. Beyond the tent sat the angular splayed-leg form of Cosmic Avenger, the heavy lander that had carried them from Rockhopper. Parry tried to read the walker's gait before his head up ID'd the approaching figure. Feldman and Shimozu moved with the cautious economy of underwater workers. They'd been transferred from Deep Shaft's Marine Division on Earth, but Mike Takahashi was a spacewalker to the marrow. Even wearing a 30-year-old Russian surplus Orlan 19, ballasted with nearly a ton of depleted uranium, he moved with a loping grace, unafraid to lose contact with the surface for long moments. The HUD bracketed Takahashi's 19 and appended his name in pulsing blue letters, accompanied by a manga-style face icon. "Nice haul, Chief." "Thanks," Parry said. "Thing is, it isn't going to get any nicer just because you keep staring at it." "I'm thinking it might need another layer," he said, hands on his hips. "Maybe just a dab down there." Takahashi stood next to him, their bulky shadows spilling into the abyss. The other man favored glacial Estonian choral music. Parry heard it seeping over the voice link. "We need you inside," Takahashi said. Parry wondered what was up. Takahashi could have called him inside easily enough without making the trek in person. "What's the story?" he asked as they walked back to the tent. "Don't know. Something's going down, that's all. You checked out the ship lately?" "A while back." "Maybe you should take another look." Parry cuffed down the binocs again. Rockhopper leapt into view as the Nikons found their focus. Everything looked the same, except that the flicker of repair torches around the head of the driver was absent, nor was there any sign of Svetlana's hovering figure. "Interesting," he said. "Good or bad?" Parry stowed his binocs. "Could go either way." He reached for the tent flap and pulled it wide enough to admit the two men. The tent was unpressurized, a stiffened, dome-shaped shelter, fabric wired with superconducting mesh to afford the bare minimum of protection against charged particles. Gillian Shimozu and Elias Feldman sat either side of a plastic packing crate, playing cards spread across the lid. The cards, some faded and crudely redrawn in magic marker, were printed on thick, texturized plastic, better for handling with spacesuit gloves. The four suits exchanged protocols with a warble. "Still time to deal you in," Shimozu said, looking up as Parry sealed the flap behind them. "I'll pass." Behind Shimozu, balanced on a bright red oxygen pump, a flexi showed a picture of Saturn with the blue logo of China Daily in the top left corner. "Spoil sport," Shimozu said, taking a card from the table. "Any word from Batista or Fletterick? There are signs we might be in business," Parry said. Feldman lowered his hand, revealing a set of aces. The driver? Looks like work's been called off. Unless Saul's managed to swing shift changes for his robots, it's got to mean we have a functioning deployment system. Whoop-de-doo, Shimozu said. She had her anti-glare visor tipped down. Its near-matte coating blocked any possible reflection from the cards in her hand. You could tone down the enthusiasm a smidge, Parry said. I'll ask again. Any word? Takahashi pointed at the screen. Maybe it doesn't have anything to do with the driver at all. They were showing Saturn just now. That why you pulled me in? Parry asked. I thought it was weird. Why show Saturn? Batista and Fletterick, Parry said patiently. Anyone? Maybe there's been an accident, Takahashi said wonderingly. The other two had dealt him into the game, but he appeared to be more interested in the screen behind Shimozu. Anyone know how to get that feed on my helmet? Use your drop-down menu, Feldman said testily, as if he'd been over this before. Select preferences, then HUD audio-visual display options, then... Parry walked past the gain to the oxygen pump and picked up the flexi, squeezing it gently so as not to injure the quasi-living thing. The main image was still Saturn, but now a pundit in an overlaid box was talking. Nobody he recognized. Chinese text ticker taped along the bottom of the screen. Maybe Takahashi was right. Maybe something was happening around Saturn. But what could be big enough to hold the attention of China Daily this long? The major news feeds made Bella Lynn's fish look like masters of sustained concentration. That was when his HUD rearranged itself spontaneously, a priority window popping open, filled with Bella's face. Parry, she said, thank goodness. I was beginning to think we'd need to send Crusader to pick you up. It appears that the repair squad cut through the power bus to the downlink. Hope you give them hell. Ordinarily I would, but now isn't the time. No one said anything. They were waiting for Parry to speak for them. The cards were on the table. What's up, Bella? Something big, she said. Big enough that I'm going to need you back on the ship, and quickly. But before you leave, I want the driver shaft prepped to accept an FAD. We don't need to chip anything off this one, Bella. She'll fall nice and stable all the way home. I'm not talking about reshaping, she said. I'm talking about blowing it out of the sky. Svetlana Barsegian dabbed bright green disinfectant onto the pressure sores around her groin, then snapped a dosimeter cuff from her wrist and checked that the mission dosage was still on the low side of 400 millisieverts. She pulled on jogging pants and a black Lockheed Khrunichev Fusion Systems t-shirt, jammed stained grey sneakers on her feet, and raked a hand through hair, flat and itchy after the spacewalk. She pushed in a pair of pink ear protectors, muting the background noise. Except for the 2 hours a day when they turned off most of the machines, it was noisier in Rockhopper than in the Orlan 18. A warren of interconnecting corridors brought her to the number 2 centrifuge. When she reached Bella's office, she saw that Craig Schrope was already there. She reminded herself to be on her best behavior. Bella invited her in, pushed a cigarette into an ashtray and said something to Svetlana. Her lips were moving, but no sound was coming out. Svetlana realized that she still had the ear protectors in. She popped them out and squeezed them back into their little plastic case, then secured it against the Velcro band of her jogging pants. "Sorry, I was suggesting you might want to take a seat," Bella said nicely. She waited patiently until Svetlana was settled on a lightweight folding chair. Bella's soundproofed and carpeted office was the largest private space in the ship. It doubled as her sleeping quarters. The walls were pastel grey, papered here and there with false colour seismic survey maps, grainy images of shipwrecks and coral reefs grabbed during scuba expeditions. The only fixture that never changed was Bella's fish tank, all 500 litres of it. Schrope hated the fish tank, Svetlana knew. It was a rule-twisting indulgence, exactly the kind of thing he'd made so many enemies stamping out on Big Red. Terrier boy, they called him back there. Word was Deep Shaft had put Schrope aboard Rockhopper to get him as far away from Mars as possible. He sat there now, next to Bella, behind the same desk, the one Jim Chisholm should have been sitting behind, twirling a company ballpoint pen and looking pleased with himself. Sorry to bring you inside at short notice, Shrope said, his voice a low, throbbing, cat-like purr. Svetlana shifted on her folding seat, but didn't reply. How'd the shift go? Bella asked. She wore shark's teeth around her neck and a faded red lumberjack shirt, open over a black vest embossed with a gold foil picture, the Titanic bar and grill. I've had better. Blacking out isn't one of my favorite ways to spend EVA time. Bella raised a knowing eyebrow. The 18s again. Same old Trimix problem. Don't forget to file the LOC log. Headquarters may make us use that reconditioned shit, but we don't have to like it. Everything's industry standard and space certified, Shrope said, picking a speck of fluff from his crisp blue deep shaft zip-up. On Hammerhead, they make do with a lot older than all N-18s without bitching and moaning. That's Hammerhead's problem, Svetlana said. The difference is they don't make an issue of it, Shrope said evenly. But since it's clearly an issue here, I've okayed a consignment of new 22s on the next rotation. Like ticking that one box on a consignment spreadsheet had been the favor of the century. Which would be when, Craig? Svetlana asked sweetly, before or after Jim gets his ticket home. Shrope batted aside her question with a flick of the pen. Bella, maybe you should fill Svetlana in on developments, since this does, obliquely, concern Jim.
What developments? Svetlana interrupted.
We've had a request to disengage, Bella said. They want us to tag the driver and leave it out here.
And the Comet?
Plenty more where that one came from. Svetlana shook her head in disbelief.
We can't just abandon it. Not after all the work we've put in. Driver pits dug. Parasol's already locked in and prepped for spin-up.
Could be we've bigger fish to go after. I need some tech input. Shrope took over.
Could we move quickly if we had to?
We're always ready to withdraw to a safe distance, Svetlana said.
I mean immediate full power for an extended cruise.
Svetlana worked her way through a mental checklist.
Yes,
she said cautiously. Normally we'd run a few more tests, especially after an extended shutdown like this one.
Understood, Bella said. But there's no compelling reason why we can't fire up.
No, but Perry and the others.
Avengers on its way back up. They'll be aboard shortly. One more thing, Svieta. Specs say we can push the engine to half a G, if we talk to it nicely. Her voice trailed off. Svetlana knew what she was asking.
Theoretically.
Bella narrowed her eyes.
Yes or no?
All right. Yes. But it's not something you'd want to do for more than a few hours. You'd be looking at accelerated wear in expensive, non-replaceable components. Elevated risk of mission-critical failure modes, not to mention the increased structural load on the rest of the ship.
Bella tapped a finger against a hard copy of a plain text email.
Lockheed Khrunichev, tell me the loads are within design limbs.
If you tell me the engine can hold, I'm a happy bunny. The document was upside down from Svetlana's perspective, but she could still make out part of the subject line, something about Janus. Mythical and Roman, she thought, the two-faced god of what? And the name of one of Saturn's moons.
It's doable, she said.
Good, Bella said, but Svetlana noticed that she said good with a sigh, as if she had secretly been hoping for a different answer.